"This is where the Italian machine gun has caught them," Sari yelled across the gap. And, as if in confirmation, there came the tearing, ripping sound of the machine guns off in the rain mist. Jake threaded the car past the pile of bodies and then looked around to make sure Vicky was following. Now, what the hell? He realized they were alone. That woman, that crazy woman! And he braked, slammed Priscilla into reverse and roared back into the fog until the dark shape of Miss Wobbly loomed up again. "No," said Gareth. "I can't bear it." Vicky and Sara were out of the parked car, hurrying amongst the piles of bodies, stooping over a wounded warrior, and between them dragging him upright and thrusting him through the open rear doors of the cab. Others, less gravely wounded, were limping and crawling towards the machine and dragging themselves aboard.
"Come on, Vicky," Jake yelled.
"We can't leave them here," she yelled back.
"We've got to get to the waterfall," he tried to explain. "We've got to stop the retreat."
But he might not have spoken, for the two women turned back to their task.
"Vicky!"
Jake shouted again.
"If you help, it won't take so long," she called obstinately.
And Jake shrugged helplessly before climbing down out of the hatch. Both cars were crammed with dreadfully wounded and dying Harari, and the hulls were thick with those who still had enough strength to hold on before Vicky was satisfied.
"We've lost 15 minutes.
Gareth glanced at his pocket watch in the rain that still poured down with unabated fury.
"And that could be enough to get us all killed and lose us the gorge."
"It was worth it,"
Vicky told him stubbornly, and ran to her car. Again, the heavily burdened machines ground on towards the mountain pass, and now they had to ignore the pitiful appeals of the wounded they passed. They lay in huddles of rags, soaked with rain and diluted pink blood, or they crawled painfully and doggedly on towards the mountains, lifting brown, agonized faces and pleading, claw-like hands as the two machines roared past in the mist. Once in a freak gap in the rain, visibility opened to a mile around them, and a pale shaft of watery sunlight slanted down to strike the cars like a stage light, glistening on the wet steel hulls. Immediately the Italian machine guns opened onto them from a range of a mere 200 yards, and the bullets cut into the clinging mass of humanity, knocking a dozen of them, shrieking from their perch before the rain closed in again, hiding them in its soft white protective bosom. They ran into the main camp below the gorge and found that it was plunged into terrible confusion. It had been heavily shelled and machine gunned, and then the rain had turned it all into a deep muddy soup of broken tukuls, flattened tents and scattered equipment. Dead horses and human corpses were half buried in the mud. Here and there a terrified dog or a lost child scurried through the rain. Spasmodic fighting was still taking place in the rocky ground around the camp, and they caught glimpses of Italian uniforms on the slopes and muzzle flashes in the gloom. Every few seconds a shell would howl in through the rain and cloud and burst with a sullen fury somewhere out of sight.
"Head for the gorge," shouted Gareth. "Don't stop here."
And Jake took the path that skirted the grove of camel thorns, the direct path that passed below and out of sight of the fighting, on the slopes, crossed the Sardi River and plunged into the gaping maw of the gorge.
"My men are holding them," Gregorius shouted proudly. "They are holding the gorge. We must go to their aid."
"Our place is at the first waterfall." Gareth raised his voice for the first time.
"We can't hold here. Not when the Itai brings up his guns. We've got to get set at the first waterfall to have a chance."
He looked back to where the other car should have been following them, and he groaned.
"No, oh, please, God, no."
"What is it?"
Jake's head popped out of the driver's hatch with alarm.
"They've done it again."
"Who?"
But Jake need not have asked. The following car had swung off the direct track and was now storming up through the rain-blurred camel-thorn trees, heading for the old tented camp in the grove, and only incidentally running directly into the area where the heavy fighting was still rattling and crackling in the rain.
"Catch her," Gareth said. "Head her off."
Jake swung off the track and went zigzagging up through the grove, with the rear wheels spinning and spraying red mud and slush.
But Miss Wobbly had a clear start and a straight run up the secondary track, directly into the enemy advance. She disappeared amongst the trees and curtains of rain. Jake brought the car bellowing out into the camp, to find Miss Wobbly parked in the open clearing. The tents had been flattened, and the whole area trodden and looted. Cases of rations and clothing burst open and soaked with rain. The muddy red canvas of the tents hung flapping in the trees or lay half buried. From the turret, Sarah was firing the Vickers into the trees of the grove. An answering fire whined and crackled about the car. Jake glimpsed running Italian figures, turned the car so that his own gun would bear. "Get into them, Greg," he yelled, and the boy crouched down behind the gun and fired a long, thunderous burst that tore shreds of bark off the trees and dropped at least one of the running Italians. Jake lifted himself out of the driver's hatch and then froze and stared in disbelief. Victoria Camberwell was out of the armoured car, plodding around in the soup of red mud, oblivious to the gunfire that wickered and crackled about her. "Vicky!" he cried in despair, and she stooped and snatched something out of the mud with a cry of triumph. Now at last she turned and scampered back to Miss Wobbly, crossing a few feet in front of Jake. "What the hell?" he protested. "My typewriter, my toilet bag," she explained reasonably, holding her muddy trophies aloft. "One has got my makeup in it, and I can't do my job without the other." And then she smiled, like a wet, bedraggled puppy. "We can go now," she said. The track up the gorge was crowded with men and animals, toiling wearily upwards in the icy rain. The pack animals slipped and slithered in the loose footing. Gareth's relief was intense when he saw the bulky shapes of the Vickers, strapped to the humpy backs of a dozen camels, and the cases of ammunition riding high in the panniers. His men had done their work and saved the guns. "Go with them, Greg," he ordered. "See them safely up to the first waterfall." And the boy jumped down to take command, while the two cars ploughed on slowly through the sea of humanity. "There's no fight left in them," said Jake, looking down into the dispirited brown faces, running with rainwater and shivering in the cold. "They'll fight," answered Gareth, and he nudged the Ras. "What do you say, Grandpa?" The Ras grinned, a weary, toothless grin, but his wet clothing clung to the gaunt old frame like the rags of a scarecrow. As Jake brought the car round the slippery, glassy hairpin bend below the first waterfall. "Pull in here," Gareth told him, and then scrambled down beside the hull, drawing the Ras down with him. "Thanks, old son." He looked up at Jake. "Take the cars up to Sardi and get rid of these..." He indicated the sorry cargo of wounded. "Try and find a suitable building for a hospital. Leave that to Vicky. It'll keep her out of mischief. Either that or we'll have to tie her up." He grinned, and then was serious. "Try and contact Lidge McHale. Tell him the position here. Tell him the Gallus have deserted, and I'll be hard-pressed to hold the gorge another week. Tell him we need ammunition, guns, medicine, blankets, food, anything he can spare. Ask him to send a train down to Sardi with supplies, and to take out the wounded." He paused and thought for a moment. "That's it, I think. Do that and then come back, with all the food you can carry. I think we left most of our supplies down there." He glanced down into the misty depths of the gorge. "And these fellas won't fight on an empty stomach." Jake reversed the car and pulled back onto the track. "Oh, and Jake, try and find a few cheroots. I lost my entire stock down there. Can't fight without a whiff or two." He grinned and waved. "Keep it warm, old son," he called, and turned away to begin stopping the trudging column of refugees, pushing them off the track towards the prepared trenches that had been dug into the rocky sides of the gorge, overlooking the double sweep of the track below them. "Come along, chaps," Gareth shouted cheerfully. "Who's for a touch of old glory?" From General Badoglio, Commander-in-Chief of the African Expeditionary Force before Amba Aradam, to Colonel Count Aldo Belli, Officer Commanding the Danakil Column at the Wells of Chaldi. "The moment for which we have planned is now at hand. Stop.
I confront the main body of the enemy, and have had them under continuous bombardment for 5 days. At dawn tomorrow, I shall attack in force, and drive them from the high ground back along the Desi Road. Do you now advance with all dispatch and take up a position astride the Desi Road, and stem the tide of the enemy's retreat, so that we may take them on both tines of the pitchfork. 40,000 men lay upon Amber Ardam, cowering in their trenches and caves. They were the heart and spine of the Ethiopian armies, and the man who led them, Ras Magluteu, was the ablest and most experienced of all the warlords. But he was powerless and uncertain in the face of such strength and fury as now broke around him. He had not imagined it could be so, and he lay with his men, quiescent and stoic. There was no enemy to confront, nothing to strike out at, for the huge Caproni bombers droned high overhead, and the great guns that fired the shells were miles below in the valley. All they could do was pull their dusty shamas over their heads and endure the bone-jarring, bowel-shaking detonations and breathe the filthy, fume-laden air. Day after day, the storm of explosive roared around them until they were dazed and stupefied, deafened and uncaring, enduring, only enduring, not thinking, not feeling, not caring. On the sixth night, the drone of the big three-engined bombers passed overhead, and Ras Magluteu's men, peering up fearfully, saw the sinister shapes pass overhead, dark against the silver pricking of the stars. They waited for the bombs to tumble down upon them once more. But the bombers circled above the flat-top mountain for many minutes, and there were no bombs. Then the bombers turned away, and the drone of the engine died into the lightning dawn sky. Only then did the soft, insidious dew that they'd sown came sifting down out of the still night air. Gently as the fall of snowflakes, it settled upon the upturned brown faces, into the fearfully staring eyes, onto the bare hands that held the ancient firearms at the ready. It burned into the exposed skin, blistering and eating into the living flesh like some terrible canker. It burned the eyes in their sockets, turning them into cherry-red glistening orbs, from which the yellow mucus poured thickly. The pain it inflicted combined both the searing of concentrated acid and the fierce heat of live coals. In the dawn, while thousands of Ras Magluteu's men whimpered and cried out in their consuming agony, and their comrades, bemused and bewildered, tried unavailingly to render aid, in that dreadful moment, the first wave of Italian infantry came up over the lip of the mountain, and they were into the Ethiopian trenches before the defenders realized what had happened. The Italian bayonets blurred redly in the first rays of the morning sun. The cloud lay upon the highlands, blocking out the peaks, and the rain fell in a constant deluge. It had rained without ceasing for the 2 days and three nights since the disaster of Amber Ardam. The rain had saved them. It had saved the 30,000 survivors of the battle from being overtaken by the same fate as had befallen the 10,000 casualties they'd left on the mountain. High above the cloud, the Italian bombers circled hungrily. Lige Mikhail could hear them clearly, although the thick blanket of cloud muted the sound of the powerful triple engines. They waited for a break in the cloud to come swooping down upon the retreat. What a target they'd enjoy if that happened. The Desi Road was choked for a dozen miles with the slow, unwieldy column of the retreat, the ragged files of trudging figures bowed in the rain, their heads covered with their shamas, their bare feet sliding and slipping in the mud. Hungry, cold, and dispirited, they toiled onwards, carrying weapons that grew heavier with each painful step. Still, they kept on. The rain had hampered the Italian pursuit. Their big troop carriers were bogged down helplessly in the treacherous mud. On each engorged mountain stream, each ravine raged with the muddy brown rainwaters. They had to be bridged by the Italian engineers before the transports could be manhandled across, and the pursuit continued. The Italian, General Badoglio, had been denied a crushing victory, and 30,000 Ethiopian troops had escaped him at Ardam.
It was Lidge Mikhail's special charge, placed upon him personally by the King of Kings, Haile Selassie, to bring out those 30,000 men, to extricate them from Badoglio's talons and regroup them with the southern army, under the emperor's personal command, upon the shores of Lake Tana. Another 36 hours and the task would be accomplished. He sat on the rear seat of the mud-spattered Ford sedan, huddled into the thick, coarse folds of his greatcoat, and although it was warm and lulling in the sedan interior, and although he was exhausted to the point at which his hands and feet felt completely numb, and his eyes as though they were filled with sand, yet no thought of sleep entered his mind. There was too much to plan, too many eventualities to meet, too many details to ponder, and he was afraid. A terrible black fear pervaded his whole being. The ease with which the Italian victory had been won at Aradam filled him with fear for the future. It seemed as though nothing could stand against the force of Italian arms, against the big guns and the bombs and the nitrogen mustard. He feared that another terrible defeat awaited them on the shores of Lake Tana. He feared also for the safety of the 30,000 in his charge. He knew that the Danakil column of the Italian expeditionary force had fought its way into the Sardi Gorge and must by now have almost reached the town of Sardi itself. He knew that Ras Gholam's small force had been heavily defeated on the plains and had suffered doleful losses in the subsequent defence of the gorge. He feared that they might be swept aside at any moment now, and that the Italian column would come roaring like a lion across his rear, cutting off his retreat to Desi. He must have time, a little more time, a mere 36 hours more. Then again he feared the Gallas. At the beginning of the Italian offensive, they'd taken no part in the fighting, but had merely disappeared into the mountains, betraying completely the trust that the Harari leaders had placed in them. Now, however, that the Italians had won their first resounding victories, the Gallas had become active, gathering like vultures for the scraps that the lions left. His own retreat from Aradam had been harassed by his erstwhile allies. They hung on his flanks, hiding in the scrub and scree slopes along the Desi Road, awaiting each opportunity to fall upon a weak, unprotected spot in the unwieldy, slow-moving column. It was classical shifter tactics, the age-old art of ambush, of hit and run, a few throats slit and a dozen rifles stolen. But it slowed the retreat, slowed it drastically, while close behind them followed the Italian horde, and across their rear lay the mouth of the Sardi Gorge. Lidge Mikhail roused himself and leaned forward in the seat to peer ahead through the windscreen. The wipers flogged sullenly from side to side, keeping two fans of clean glass in the mud-splattered screen. And Lidge Mikhail made out the railway crossing ahead of them, where it bisected the muddy, rutted road. He grunted with satisfaction, and the driver pushed the Ford through the slowly moving mass of miserable humanity which clogged the road. It opened only reluctantly as the sedan butted its way through, with the horn blaring angrily, and closed again behind it as it passed. They reached the railway level crossing, and Lidge Mikhail ordered the driver to pull off the road beside a group of his officers. He slipped out bareheaded, and immediately the rain dewed on his bushy dark hair. The group of officers surrounded him, each eager to tell his own story, to recite the list of his own requirements, his own misgivings, each with news of fresh disaster, new threats to their very existence. They had no comfort for him, and Lidge Mikhail listened with a great weight growing in his chest. At last he gestured for silence. "Is the telephone line to Sardi still open?" he asked. "The Gallas have not yet cut it off. It does not follow the railway line, but crosses the spur of Ambassacal. They must have overlooked it. Have me connected with the Sardi station. I must speak to somebody there. I must know exactly what is happening in the gorge." He left the group of officers beside the railway tracks and walked a short way along the Sardi spur. Down there, a few short miles away, the close members of his family, his father, his brothers, his daughter, were risking their lives to buy him the time he needed. He wondered what price they'd already paid. And suddenly a mental picture of his daughter sprang into his mind. Sara, young and lithe and laughing. Firmly he thrust the image aside, and he turned to look back at the endless file of bedraggled figures that shuffled along the Desi Road. They were in no condition to defend themselves. They were helpless as cattle until they could be regrouped, fed and rearmed in spirit. Now, if the Italians came now, it would be the end. Excellency, the line to Sardia is open. Will you speak? Lij Mikhail turned back and went to where a field telephone had been hooked into the Sardi Desi telephone line. The copper wires dangled down from the telegraph poles overhead, and Lij Mikhail took the handset that the officer handed him and spoke quietly into the mouthpiece. Beside the station master's office in the railway yards of Sardi town stood the long cavernous warehouse used for the storage of grain and other goods. The roof and walls were clad with corrugated galvanized iron, which had been daubed a dull rusty red with oxide paint. The floor was of a raw concrete, and the cold mountain wind whistled in through the joints in the corrugated sheets. At 100 places, the roof leaked where the galvanizing had rusted away, and the rain dripped steadily, forming icy puddles on the bare concrete floor. There were almost 600 wounded and dying men crowded into the shed. There was no bedding or blankets. An empty grain bag served the purpose. They lay in long lines on the hard concrete, and the cold came up through the thin jute bags, and the rain dripped down upon them from the high roof. There was no sanitation, no bedpans, no running water. Most of the men were too weak to hobble out into the slush of the goods yard. The stench was a solid, tangible thing that permeated the clothing and clung in a person's hair. Long artery left the shed. There was no antiseptic, no medicine, not even a bottle of Lysol or a packet of Aspro. The tiny store of medicines at the missionary hospital had long ago been exhausted. The German doctor worked on into each night with no anesthetic and nothing to combat the secondary infection. Already the stink of putrefying wounds was almost as strong as the other stench. The most hideous injuries were the burns inflicted by the nitrogen mustard. All that could be done was to smear the scalded and blistered flesh with locomotive grease. They'd found 2 drums of this in the loco shed. Vicky Camberwell had slept for 3 hours, 2 days ago. Since then, she'd worked without ceasing, among the long, pitiful lines of bodies. Her face was deathly pale in the gloom of the shed, and her eyes had receded into dark, bruised craters. Her feet were swollen from standing so long, and her shoulders and her back ached with a dull, unremitting agony. Her linen dress was stained with specks of dried blood and other less savoury secretions, and she worked on in despair that there was so little they could do for the hundreds of casualties. She could help them to drink the water they cried out for, clean those that lay in their own filth, hold a black, pleading hand as the man died, and then pull the coarse jute sacking up over the face and signal one of the overworked male orderlies to carry him away and bring in another from where they were already piling up on the open stoop of the shed. One of the orderlies stooped over her now, shaking her shoulder urgently, and it was some seconds before she could understand what he was saying. Then she pushed herself stiffly up off her knees and stood for a moment holding the small of her back with both hands while the pain there eased and the dark giddiness in her head abated. Then she followed the orderly out across the muddy, fouled yard to the station office. She lifted the telephone receiver to her ear and her voice was husky and slurred as she said her name. "Miss Camberwell, this is Lij Mikhail here." His voice was scratchy and remote, and she could hardly catch the words, for the rain still rattled on the iron roof above her head. "I'm at the Desi crossroads." "The train," she said, her voice firming. "Lij Mikhail, where is the train you promised? We must have medicine. Antiseptic, anesthetic. Do you understand? There are 600 wounded men here. Their wounds are rotting. They're dying like animals." She recognized the rising hysteria in her voice, and she cut herself off. "Miss Camberwell, the train, I am sorry. I sent it to you with supplies, medicines. Another doctor. It left Dessie yesterday morning and passed the crossroads here yesterday evening on its way down the gorge to Sade."
"Where is it, then?" demanded Vicky.
"We must have it. You don't know what it's like here."
"I'm sorry, Miss Camberwell. The train will not reach you.
It was derailed in the mountains, 15 miles north of Sade. Rascula's men, the Gallas, were in ambush. They had torn up the tracks. They have massacred everybody aboard and burned the coaches."
There was a long silence between them. Only the static hissed and buzzed across the wires.
"Miss Camberwell, are you there?"
"Yes."
"Do you understand what I'm saying?"
"Yes, I understand."
"There will be no train."
"No."
"Rascola has cut the road between here and Sade."
"Yes."
"Nobody can reach you, and there is no escape from Sade up the railway line. Rascola has 5,000 men to hold it. His position in the mountains is impregnable. He can hold the road against an army."
"We're cut off," said Vicky thickly.
"The Italians in front of us, the Gallas behind us."
Again the silence between them. Then Lige Mikhail asked,
"Where are the Italians now, Miss Camberwell?"
"They're almost at the head of the gorge, where the last waterfall crosses the road." She paused and listened intently, removing the receiver from her ear. Then she lifted it again. "You can hear the Italian guns. They're firing all the time now. So very close."
"Miss Camberwell, can you get a message to Major Swales?"
"Yeah."
"Tell him I need another 18 hours. If you can hold the Italians until noon tomorrow, then they cannot reach the crossroads before it is dark tomorrow night. It will give me another day and 2 nights. If he can hold until noon, he will have discharged with honour all his obligations to me. And you will have all earned the undying gratitude of the Emperor and all the peoples of Ethiopia. You, Mr. Barton, and Major Swales."
"Yes," said Vicky.
Each word was an effort.
"Tell him that at noon tomorrow I shall have made the best arrangements I can for your evacuation from Sade. Tell him to hold hard until noon. Then I will spare no effort to get all of you out of there."
"I'll tell him."
"Tell him that at noon tomorrow he is to order all the remaining Ethiopian troops to disperse into the mountains, and I will speak to you again on this telephone to tell you what arrangements I have been able to make for your safety."
"Lit Mikhail, what about the wounded? The ones who cannot disperse into the hills?"
The silence again, and then the prince's voice, quiet but heavy with grief.
"It would be best if they fell into the hands of the Italians, rather than the Gallus."
"Yes," she agreed quietly.
"There is one other thing, Miss Camberwell."
The prince hesitated and then went on firmly.
"Under no circumstances are you to surrender yourselves to the Italians. Even in the most extreme circumstances, anything," he emphasized the word, "anything is preferable to that."
"Why?"
"I have learned from our agents that sentence of death has been passed on you, Mr. Barton and Major Swales. You have been declared agents provocateurs and terrorists. You are to be handed over to the Rascula for execution and sentence. Anything would be better than that."
"I understand," said Vicky softly, and she shuddered as she thought of Rascula's thick pink lips and the soft bloated hands.
"If everything else fails, I will send an..."
His voice was cut off abruptly, and now there was no hiss of static across the wires. Only the dead silence of lost contact. For another minute, Vicky tried to re-establish contact, but the handset was mute and the silence complete. She replaced it on its cradle and closed her eyes tightly for a moment to steady herself. She'd never felt so lonely and tired and afraid in her entire life.